Yeah, we're not doing the movie review this week. This isn't, no, I'm kidding. Here's Mark with the movie review.
I was thinking, what's going on here? Hang on a second. We were just talking about it.
I know. Well, I thought you're going to be your first. If you haven't guessed already, that intro by Queen, that's the 20th Century Fox logo or intro. And it's been redone by Queen. So that is going to be the first movie we're reviewing, isn't it, Mark?
Yes, Bohemian Rhapsody, which is a chronicle of the years leading up to Queen's legendary appearance at the Live Aid concert. So, you know, arguably, Queen are one of the biggest and best rock acts on the planet. So really, they should have one of the biggest and best biopics possible. You would kind of think that.
Yeah.
And Bohemian Rhapsody, I think it just about manages to pull that off, to be honest with you. I mean, don't expect anything deep or wholly controversial here.
Yeah, I am hearing a mixed bag, I've got to be honest on this
one. Yeah, it's a very surface-only film. So, you know, very quickly the film moves between them being putting the band together and then getting a record deal, and then they're off playing gigs around the world. You know, it's very formulaic, it's very safe. You know, they clearly had problems trying to get a record deal, like most bands did and still do, but this doesn't feel like they ever had a problem. It was kind of like, oh, they're Queen, we better give them a record deal. So, you know, a bit of a problem with that. Also, a lot is glossed over in terms of Freddie Mercury's homosexuality.
Yeah, I've heard that, and which is not really good to see.
Yeah, I mean, he touches on it a couple of times, but it just, you know, it's not a deep dive into it. Okay, fine. I understand that maybe we don't need to go all the way, because this is a Queen biopic. It's not Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, but that was such an integral part, and the way he lived his life,
yes,
as I understood it anyway, was very much part of who he was.
Yeah, absolutely. I get the feeling that maybe they didn't go as deep as they could with Freddie's personal life for fear of alienating some film goers.
Yeah, I heard a few things ended up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, it's very strange, because I don't know if you know this, but it's directed by Bryan Singer. However, Bryan Singer was left it 3 weeks before it finished.
And I didn't know that.
Yeah, no. And they drafted in Dexter Fletcher. Now, Dexter Fletcher was originally going to make this film several years ago, and then he couldn't get it made. Bryan Singer came in. Bizarrely, there is an entire sequence in this film that feels like it is from a completely different film. And I get the feeling that that's maybe what Dexter Fletcher has filmed. I have to say, I think it's probably the deepest we'll get to understanding Freddie Mercury's, you know, his private life.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that about it. The rest of the film is a little bit too light and a little bit too airy. So, you know, the film itself is too easygoing. However, it's got two things going for it. One of them are the songs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we all know the songs. To watch and learn how all of these classics are put together is fascinating. And also to watch Freddie Mercury sit at the piano and slowly play Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, well, I still remember, like many people do, I mean, at my age and any other age, I mean, that I think it was 20-odd minutes, 22 minutes, I can't remember exactly what it was, but we're going to play a song from that anyway in between the movie review, but that 20 minutes at Live Aid, just incredible.
Yeah, and the thing is, you watch them put these songs together, and it is spine-tingling, you know, it's hairs on the back of the neck standing up and whatever else. The other very good thing that this film does is it's one actor, Rami Malek, playing Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, I've seen him. Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. It's not as though you're watching an actor. It looks, it sounds, it feels like you're watching
Freddie
Mercury.
And he wasn't
Freddie
the first
Mercury.
Choice, was he?
He wasn't. It was Sacha Baron Cohen, who left because he had an argument with the producers.
I know.
So kind of Rami Malek was drafted in at the last minute. And I've got to say, I think he is the embodiment of Freddie Mercury. The flamboyance is there, the bravado, the focused mind, but also the paranoia, the worry about the private life and, you know, what's going on around him as well. So I think it's such a towering performance that actually it takes the film from being good to being great because of this. So what I will say is, don't expect a deep dive into Queen and Freddie Mercury. It is very much a greatest hits package, but what a greatest hits it is to talk about.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, these are one of the greatest bands in the world. And I guarantee you're going to shed a tear or two, but also you're going to leave on such a high that when you get back in the car or when you're walking home or something, you're going to need a Queen greatest hits to listen to.
Yeah, it will open up. What I like about this is it will open up a whole new lot of people and viewers and listeners and everything else to Queen's music.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know much about Queen. My brother was always into Queen. He was 3 years older than me. And he had lots of Queen records, and I just remembered him playing them all.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as I got older, I understood more about the music and liked more of the music. And then, of course, I think I was 16 in 85, 16, 17, and obviously everyone remembers Live Aid.
Yes.
Of my age group, that's for sure.
Well, the end of the film is Live Aid. And yeah. I've got to say, it's 20 minutes, something like that. It's almost real time, to be honest with you. And it is the best moment in the film because you just sit there and they've recreated it very well. But you just sit there and you go, wow, this is the moment that Freddie Mercury's life was building up to. As if he wasn't already a big star. It's that 20 minutes where he came on stage and just wowed everybody around the world. It wasn't just the UK, it was around the world.
It was incredible. I still remember it like it was yesterday. It was incredible. Everybody's talked about it. Everybody.
Yeah, yeah. And you find out what actually went on, why they got that gig in the film as well. And that's very interesting, actually. It's a very good story.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, we're going to play Bohemian Rhapsody, the actual live version from Live Aid, after we do the next film, which is, hopefully I'm going to pronounce this right, but Utøya.
Utøya. I think it's Utøya.
Obviously Norwegian.
Yes, Utøya, July 22nd. It's the story of a teenage girl who struggles to survive and find her younger sister during the July 2011 terrorist mass murder at the political summer camp on the Norwegian island of Utøya. Just got to be clear about this. This is not the same film that is on Netflix at the moment.
Oh, okay.
That is July 22nd, directed by Paul Greengrass. That is a much more wider, more expansive film. This one is a very small, closed, claustrophobic film, and it's told from the perspective of just one of the survivors.
Well, that's good to know, because I certainly didn't know that myself. So.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, because obviously, you know, the same title just about. So this is a story of Katja, who is trying to find her sister as the events are unfolding. It's very shaky camera work. It's all unfolding in real time as well. So it's kind of on the shoulder of Katja as she's running and she's hiding and she's running and she's hiding. And impressively, but I will say also brutally, the film is a non-stop terror ride.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is actually what happened. And it's not a horror movie. It's real life. And I think it is, you kind of have to steel yourself for it. You have to be prepared for it. So, you know, not even 10 minutes into the film, all of a sudden there are gunshots ringing out through the woods and the kids are running off. And it kind of throws you as well because you're thinking, okay, I kind of know what's happening. But at the same time, because of the way the camera is, it's throwing you about the place as well. So, you know, you have to, it kind of heightens every emotion you have in the cinema watching it because you're not sure what's happening. And the thing is with this film is it doesn't show the terrorist at all. And whereas, you know, we are used to films showing the terrorist at some point, this never does. This is all about the survivors. So you constantly hear the shots ringing out. And what happens is because you're following Katja, you're kind of constantly thinking, well, where is the terrorist? Where is it in the film? And, you know, normally what happens is when we're watching a film like that, when they come into view, you don't relax, but you kind of feel like, okay, I know where they are. I can visually see them. But you don't see them in this film at all. And I think it's a very interesting idea from the filmmakers to not...
Yeah, I can see where the director's going with it.
Yeah.
Or trying to, anyway.
Yeah, not give a voice to the terrorists, basically. They're giving a voice to the survivors of it as well. And these voices that are on film, especially Katja's, are some of the most devastating and heartbreaking you'll ever hear.
Well, it's an awful story, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. So, you know, it may be performed by actors, but it's all based on the true events. It's all based on the real words that were said as well. So it's a film that not only do you have to be in the right frame of mind to watch, but you also have to be brave enough to watch it. I will say that it is a very, very tough watch. It is a movie that, you know, with these tough films comes brave filmmaking. And this is brave filmmaking, I think. And it's from a Norwegian director as well. So I think... It is, yeah, it's a very tough watch. But one thing I did take away from this was, even in the darkest moments, there was still hope. There's still hope in there. And I think that's a very profound message in a film, especially about this.
Yeah, I mean, and it wasn't, I can't remember what year it was. It was obviously an awful event, I remember.
2011.
It was really.
Yeah.
So, and that brings up neatly my next question then. Do you think it's too early, or is it still in the, or do they want to do that because it's still in the memory?
It's very difficult to know when is too early and when is too late, I think. Well, certainly with any film, I mean, you don't want a film coming out 6 months after, because then they're cashing in. But at the same time, I think maybe now, you know, we're talking 7 years down the line, maybe now, as long as it's faithful, yeah, and as long as it is respectful to the victims, I would say, then it could come out at any time. I think this does a very good job of honouring those people who were involved in this. But as I said, very, very tough watch. Very tough watch.
Yeah, maybe, yeah, got to be in the right mood for that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I just think the hairs are actually going on the back of my neck, just that end bit, because it just triggered a memory. Just fantastic. Bohemian Rhapsody, of course, with the amazing Freddie Mercury and Queen. Okay, we're on to DVDs now, and Ocean's 8. I own all the others, but confess, I've not seen this one at all. I don't know why, I just haven't seen it.
It came out of the cinema. Sadly, nobody saw it. Now it's out on DVD.
That's probably why.
Yeah, yeah. So now it's out on DVD, so we can talk about it a bit more. So this is Ocean's 8. It's the story of Debbie Ocean, who's Danny Ocean's sister. She gathers an all-female crew to attempt an impossible heist at the New York City's Met Gala. You know, you might kind of... Well, it might sound... from the title like it's a prequel to Ocean's 11, it is in fact a sequel to Ocean's 13.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it operates in the same rough time frame as well. It's just the opposite side of America. This is set on the East Coast, that was on the West Coast. The thing is, with heist movies, you need two things. You need a twisting storyline that keeps you guessing, and you need plenty of jokes.
Yeah.
Well, I will say Ocean's 8 has both of those, and much like the previous films, it does it with great entertainment. It relishes doing it from the off.
I've certainly heard good things about it.
Yes.
I don't know why I never went to see it. Maybe my daughter didn't fancy it. I can't remember. But
well, the good thing is now, obviously, it's on DVD. You can see it. This is a great thing. It's cool. It's slick. It speeds along. It's got great storytelling. The sequence of getting the crew together is, as you would expect, very fun. It's entertaining. Each character is like a jigsaw piece.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that. Is it done in a similar kind of way?
It's done exactly the same. That's the thing. It doesn't stray too far from the formula, but the formula works.
Yeah.
So why would you?
Absolutely.
You know, Sandra Bullock is Debbie Ocean. She's putting the crew together with her ably assisted longtime friend Lou, played by Kate Blanchett.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's some good big name actors in here.
Well, I've seen the cast. It's a great cast.
Mindy Kaling, Awkwafina, Helen Bonham Carter, Rihanna, Anne Hathaway. And Anne Hathaway plays the mark in this. She plays an international superstar, Daphne Kluger.
Yeah.
And through these series of elaborate, yes, but yet very well done plot points, the female crew ensure that Kluger has this diamond necklace on her neck as she goes to the New York City Met Gala, and it's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And they are going to steal it while the party is in full flow. So, you know, I mean, it is typical Ocean's stuff. It's, you know, it's classic Ocean's heist movie. To say any more on the plot, I think, will spoil a lot of the twists.
Fair enough.
The jokes I will talk about, they're all the way through. It's never boring. It's constantly funny. You know, it is one of those that you think to yourself, okay, I'm laughing along, but at the same time, are they actually pulling a con job here? I'm not too sure. You know, you're constantly on edge because you're thinking about, are they actually doing something now, or are they just talking? Or
yeah,
are they just
I like
jokes?
That, though. I should we'll definitely watch that. In fact, I might even, on the way home, I'll have a look, if it's in Sainsbury's, I'll grab it for tonight. And I will check that out.
Well, the entire female ensemble in this are absolutely fantastic. So for me, it's as good as Ocean's 13, which was behind Ocean's 11, but better than Ocean's 12. I hope we get an Ocean's 10 and 11, because judging on Ocean's 8, sorry, I hope we get Ocean's 9 and 10, because judging on what we have in Ocean's 8, it's more good fun.
Good stuff, but can I just say one thing?
Go on.
Please, no Al Pacino running a casino.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, we won't go there. That's the thing, yeah.
Right, okay. Extro. I love Al Pacino, by the way. I know Mark does also, but it's just, Extro, re-released for Halloween.
Yes, so let's talk about a Halloween movie. So bizarrely, there isn't that many scary movies out this week on DVD. In fact, there is just Extro and a film called Patient Zero. So I thought we'd choose Extro.
Did you know that this week is actually 40 years since the original Halloween movie?
So that's even worse. 40 years.
Yeah, 40
and still years. One of the best.
There's a great picture. I actually retweeted it this morning of the original, and then Jamie Lee Curtis with a picture of the new one.
Amazing.
It's really cool.
Amazing. And that one and the new one's doing so well.
Sorry, we're going off topic.
We should talk about Extro.
Sticking with Halloween.
So Extro is from the early 80s, actually. It's a story of a man who was abducted by aliens, returns to his family 3 years later, but he's no longer the man he was before. Now, this is a film that throws absolutely everything, including the kitchen sink, at the screen. It's kind of like a Mad Libs of horror movies, basically. So it's part sci-fi, it's part family drama, it's part thriller, it's part horror. I will say not all of it works. However, there are some moments in this film that are totally worth seeing. There is a very iconic and legendary alien birth scene. If you've seen the film, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, it is so bizarre. And actually quite freaky as well. The interesting thing to note about this film is that it's always discussed as one of the films that was banned under the Video Nasties Act of the 80s.
Was it really?
And it's not. It was never banned. It was never taken off the shelves, but it is incorrectly always labelled as one. It just sort of disappeared.
Well, you've just triggered another memory, because I remember actually Gremlins actually was, they weren't happy about the rating that they gave Gremlins, because the similar kind of thing, I would imagine.
That's just triggered
my memory.
So, I mean, here we have a film that is very 80s. The monsters in it, the aliens or whatever you want to call them, are men in suits. They are rubber reality, so to speak. You know, they're all in the prosthetics. But what I will say is the prosthetics are really good in this. Considering this is very early 80s, they're very scary. It doesn't look like, you know, it's hanging by a thread or anything. They're actually very scary and very old-fashioned as well. And you know, in this day and age of CGI and everything, it's kind of nice to go back to that classic, VHS tape type look, you know, that we had.
Well, that was the time of John Landis and all the thriller stuff, and all, obviously American Werewolf in London, that kind of that makeup, which was obviously iconic back then. So
yeah,
that was of that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we haven't got iconic makeup in Extra.
No, I'm just saying
it's kind of fun though to see it actually. And as I said, it is quite scary. If you see the cover of the Blu-ray that's come out, it's very scary actually. It's all filmed in and around Westminster. It's got this dark.
Well, that's scary enough.
Well, here's the other thing. It's got this like dark and grimy look about it as well. So, you know, it's twice as bad. And then the father returns. And when he returns, he's weird and he's very creepy as well. And then when he starts acting out, his ex-wife and his son start to suspect things might not be all okay with him. It's a very, I want to say, unique film, to be honest with you. It doesn't really fit in any one genre. It never did. It doesn't now. And it's a difficult film to describe because of so much is going on in it. I think the one word I would use for this film is trippy.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. It's, as I said, it's so difficult to describe. And it is one of those films where I was watching it in the week and I found myself thinking, I don't know what's going on here, but I can't stop watching it because it is so trippy.
Yeah, I shall have to take a look. So it's never actually been on a streaming service. It's just been re-released for DVD.
As far as I'm, first time on Blu-ray. And the interesting thing about this is they have three different cuts of the film because the UK had a different ending to others as well, so there completely different versions on it.
Oh, well, interesting. Okay, and finally, The Bookshop.
Yeah, I thought we should speak about this because this is a lovely little film, a huge change of pace. It's set in a small Suffolk town during 1959 where a woman decides, against polite yet ruthless local opposition, to open a bookshop. Okay. The decision soon turns into a political minefield. Now, there are some films that are so quaint and so quintessentially British, you can't help but enjoy them. The Bookshop is one of those.
It sounds like it.
It is. It's not filled with loud bangs. It's not crammed with CGI or buckets of blood. It's a slow, quiet film. Florence Green loves her books, and she wants to spread that love onto other people by opening this bookshop. Yet, the upper-class people in the town don't like it. They don't want the lower class to be educated, basically. So they wage this war against her, basically. And Florence, when she's met with the opposition, you kind of think to yourself, why has somebody got a beef with having a bookshop open? Yet this is the whole point, is that, you know, it kind of answers a question about why, but in a very placid manner, and, you know, it kind of gets your back up as well as to how ridiculous it is. There's a great scene where Florence comes face to face with the woman who's doing this mastermind plot to get rid of the bookshop, basically, and her name is Violet, and she is a nasty piece of work. Very, very nasty, but not initially. She is a very two-faced person because initially she's very friendly with Florence and then it slowly creeps out and the real arguments kick out as well. And it's the only moment in the film where it gets really loud, where they're shouting at each other as well. So it's one that, you know, Florence feels like she hasn't done anything wrong. It's the locals who are actually berating her for it. And, you know, it's the whole film gets hardly above a quiet whisper at all. It's one of those beautiful films that you just sit back. It's kind of like a Sunday afternoon film.
Yeah. Well, it sounds good. It sounds like right up my street, actually, because it's a lot of people could probably resonate with some of the story, which I guess is what the director's after. So.
Yeah, well, Florence is played by Emily Mortimer, who does this great job of straddling Hollywood blockbusters and really small independent movies. And she's absolutely terrific here. There's real emotion in her performance. You know, you can feel everything. She just wants to give these books to these kids. And yet the locals in the village, they don't want that at all. So, you know, she's pulling back. Also, I will say, there is a Bill Nye's in this as well. Now, Bill Nye sort of plays the same character in virtually every film nowadays.
Surely not.
But what happens is, in this one, he's much more reserved, quite tender as well, and there's a little bit of romance going on with Bill Nye in this.
Bless him.
I haven't. Yeah, exactly. This is the thing. Haven't seen it in ages, this. So it's a very different performance from him. This is, you know, this is not going to be for everybody. I get that. But honestly, it is a lovely little film. It's about compassion. It's about sensitivity as well. And it's about small communities and how, actually, you know what? Maybe change is good for some people. So it is one movie that, you know, it just kind of struck a chord with me.
The Movie Review, every Friday at 3:30 on Phoenix FM.